This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska.
Welcome to Talking History and the second show in our four-part series on the myth of the gunfighter in the American West. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Marley Brandt about Jesse James, perhaps the most famous gunfighter of all, and hearing from another historian, Claire McKenna, on the actual extent of gunfighting in the West. Was it as common as the westerns of popular culture would suggest? We shall see. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, American researchers have discovered new evidence long buried in British military archives that famed U.S. aviator Amelia Earhart died on Kikamoro Island in the Polynesian Republic of Kiribati. Earhart's fate has been the subject of much speculation since she disappeared on July 2, 1937, while piloting a plane across the Pacific in an effort to become the first woman to fly around the world. British soldiers found bones on the island in 1940. Suspecting the bones were Earhart's, they sent them to a physician who concluded that they were the bones of a male. The International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, that has been searching for evidence of Earhart's demise for 10 years, recently discovered the long-lost report, and upon re-examining it, found that the doctor may have been wrong. The bones may have belonged to a woman who fits the aviator's physical description. Unfortunately, the bones themselves are nowhere to be found, so the search continues. You're listening to Talking History.
Jesse James! Jesse James! He was cursed with a quick and reckless gun, Jesse James, and he played the game that no man ever won, Jesse James, but his killing...
In the first show in our series on the myth of the gunfighter, we talked about the origins of America's obsession with outlaws of the Old West and the violent lives that they led. This week, we're going to take a look at one gunfighter in particular, Jesse James. So many legends have been spun around the life of Jesse James that we can hardly separate myth from reality without the help of an expert. Fortunately, we have such an expert with us today. Marley Brand is the author of Jesse James, The Man and the Myth, published this year by Berkeley Books. Reviewers have praised the author's insight not only into the life of Jesse James, but also into the period in which he lived, presenting the facts while dispelling the fiction, which is exactly what we want to do today. Welcome, Marley, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Marley, just how exaggerated is the myth or legend of Jesse James?
That's very complicated. Well, a lot of the myth of Jesse James has some basis in reality. The character of Jesse James has been subject to the whim of Hollywood. In the 30s, it was a dashing, almost hero who put everything on the line for mom, apple pie, and the farm. And in the 50s, he was the rebel with somewhat of a cause. By the 70s, he was a loony. And in the 80s and 90s, there have been attempts to examine the causes of his rebellion. The legends portray Jesse as daring, and he was that. The myth is that he was antisocial and surly. Nothing could be further from the truth. Myth and legend have him as a cold-blooded killer. Not really. That was more his brother Frank. The closest the myths and the legends have come to describing the real Jesse is that he was a larger-than-life figure in his own time.
Well, we'll want to touch on each of those. Did the myth precede the coming of film and television?
Well, yes, mostly because of Jesse. He had a driving desire to be noticed. And that could have been because of his position in his family or the abandonment by his father or whatever other psychological issues he may have had. But he was very interested in promoting himself. He loved the attention that the robbers of the Liberty Bank, Missouri Bank, received. And he realized that by denying that he had been involved, which he may or may not have been, he could draw attention to himself on a statewide, maybe even a national level. So he enlisted the help of his friend John Newman Edwards, who was a former Confederate officer who was at that time the editor of the Kansas City Star. And together they put together a publicity campaign that constantly had Jesse's name in front of the public. He would write letters to the editor denouncing his enemies and denying involvement in the robberies. And Edwards wrote editorials along those same lines, and through that the public became familiar with Jesse and his legend began to grow.
When approximately would Edwards have started this series?
That would be in the late 1860s.
So fairly early on in Jesse's career.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it almost started immediately with the first robbery.
And what was the image initially when he first started to make the press? What was the myth created so soon?
Well, it was after the Civil War, and so there was a lot of attention that was thrown on the, especially in Missouri, on the guerrilla fighters, of which Jesse was one. And there was this whole, the South was not ready to be defeated. By many of the people there, the war, they couldn't put the war behind them. So this was a popular way for them to express their views through the press, you know, with Edwards being the spearhead of that movement.
Okay. Did, unlike other heroes, or maybe perhaps like other heroes, they made it into actually these dime novels, what we refer to in the late 19th century. Did James make it into any of that kind of literature?
Oh, absolutely. Soon after he began to be popular in the Missouri press, he was the subject of quite a few overblown stories of daring adventures in the dime novels.
And those were written largely back east?
Yes, they were.
Okay.
The newspaper outside his regional influence joined the ranks of those who examined the robberies that were being committed in the Midwest. It's in the legend. The local curiosity was a national legend.
Interesting. Okay, let me take you back to a point you made earlier. I want to get back earlier in Jesse James' life. What was the impact of the Civil War on James turning to crime?
Well, his family came from the South, and his father's estate had more than a dozen slaves. And even though the slaves were considered a part of the family, it wasn't difficult for his mother to pick a side. And what motivated Jesse and Frank and their mother more than the slavery issue was the fact that they didn't like being told what to do or to have their minds up made for them. And Frank James was able to join the Confederate sympathizers in Missouri, but Jesse couldn't because he was too young. He was told to stay and help out on his family's farm. And after Frank joined with Quantrill's guerrilla soldiers, the Union soldiers were a common sight at the James family. They let horses loose, they burned fields, they beat Jesse and his mother, his pregnant mother, and eventually hung his stepfather until he was brain damaged. All this in an attempt to get the family to reveal Quantrill's whereabouts. So by the time Jesse was old enough to join Quantrill, he'd had enough. He was only 15 years old, but he made a vindictive, vengeful, and ruthless recruit. And the war would remain an issue with him for the rest of his life.
So it's an act of vengeance on his part, or
yes,
revenge.
That's how it started.
And why would he turn to crime, necessarily, or bank robbing as a way of getting revenge?
Well, he would never forget or forgive the way he and his family were treated during the war. And after he started to recuperate from, he was shot while attempting to surrender, and he nearly died. And he went back to the farm to recuperate and attempt to repair their life. But because he and his brother had been with Quantrill, it was determined by the powers that be that they were to be arrested and hung. So they were outlaws, whether or not they chose to be from that point on. They weren't allowed to take jobs, and they weren't allowed to move freely in their community or put the war behind them. So they decided, since they had no money and they had a powerful need for revenge, they turned to robbing the banks of the Union establishment.
So this is kind of the pop psychology of the romanticized James at this point, the taking vengeance on what happened to him and his family during the war.
Yes, except it had nothing to do with the railroad going through their farm.
Right, right. Understand. Okay, in your book you talk about James as a career rebel. I think you've suggested a bit of that already, but maybe you could expand on that a little bit.
Well, although he said he tried to live a normal life, he became addicted to demonstrating his rebellion against the Yankee establishment. He had a need for revenge that always dictated his lifestyle.
And does this relate at all to your referring to him as a political activist? I mean, how do those two relate?
Well, Jesse, Frank, and the younger brothers came to represent the need for rebellion felt by the pro-Confederate veterans and people of Missouri. And their actions against a smothering, unfair Union Reconstruction represented the so-called losers of the war. And although those people weren't out robbing banks and trains, even though some of them would later, they supported the James Younger gang by offering them shelter and food and alibi. And you know, the gang had many supporters. That's why Jesse was never caught.
Did he at all fit the image that sometimes we still see in stories of James about being a 19th century Robin Hood?
Sometimes he would. That really wasn't his main motivation. He was very generous to his family and to his friends. There weren't very many. A lot of the folklore says that, you know, he gave to widows and orphans and all of that. And he may have done that, but that wasn't really his motivation for robbing.
maybe we should drop back here. How does he differ, you suggested earlier a bit of this, from his brother Frank and from the Youngers? I know you also wrote about the Youngers in one of your earlier books. Could you differentiate them in some way?
They were actually quite different, and a lot of the myth and legend of Jesse James was in reality Frank James. Frank quoted Shakespeare and had a level head. Jesse was impulsive and intense. But a lot of the cold-blooded killer image that Jesse has was really Frank James. That's the way that Frank James was. Jesse was very gregarious. He really liked people, and he had a need to have people like him, which doesn't always come out. He quoted the Bible, and he felt that a lot of his actions were sanctioned by God, as most sociopaths do.
Right.
But Jesse was fun-loving and had a quick wit. Frank was more the serious brooding type that really had the need for revenge that had nothing to do with elevating his status. A lot of the revenge that he would get involved with, he didn't have the need for people to know that it was him. He would just go out and kill somebody. Jesse wasn't like that.
Interesting. How about the Youngers?
The Youngers were more along Jesse's line, too, although Cole Younger in particular was, again, someone that liked to be recognized and known. And he was, of course, the first Younger that became involved in all of this, and he was that way. He had a lot of friends, and he felt very righteous about his revenge, too. And then the younger brothers of Cole were just kind of in it for the adventure.
If you could pick an event in James's life, his adult life, that you feel was the most dramatic and perhaps at the same time the most interesting in terms of how it was interpreted for the public as part of the myth, what would that be?
Oh, my goodness.
I know there were many, but could you pick one in particular?
Well, the events all go back to the war. I mean, you know, the hanging of his stepfather as a youth was really something that shadowed a lot of his actions, because he just felt that was so unfair, and he lost his stepfather was a doctor, and he was hung until he was brain damaged, and he just felt that was so unfair. So a lot of the events that came out of that, I mean, there was the Northfield robbery, of course, which was late in his career with the James Younger gang, and it was very unpopular within the gang because he was coercing young Bob Younger to go to Minnesota, and the rest of the gang didn't really want to go, and of course the consequences were awful, and the Youngers were in prison for the rest of their life, and I think that was very dramatic for him. That kind of changed him into being very paranoid. You know, felt he could never trust anybody again, because he had been with them for most of his outlaw career, and when he had to get new recruits, he couldn't trust them, and he started doing impulsive acts at that point, which really changed, you know, it resulted in his assassination.
Yeah, Northfield is certainly one of those incidents that makes it into all of the James films at one point or another.
Yeah. So.
What about his assassination? There's so much myth surrounding that. I remember even as a young man reading various, you know, pop novels, and they all had different versions of the assassination. Give us the facts first. What actually happened?
Well, at that point in his life, he felt that, I believe that Jesse allowed himself to be killed because he was tired of the outlaw life and he saw no other way out. He was warned that the people that he was associating with couldn't be trusted. Even his own mother believed that. Yet he was with them, and he had them into his own home. He was desperate at that time, really, to find someone that he felt that he could associate with. His friends were, a lot of his friends were gone, or, you know, they didn't want to be associated with him anymore. And he picked these two young men and brought them into his home and wanted to plan this one last robbery. That was what he said. He wanted to get the money to retire. And that's what he was doing at the time that they were in his home. And they had, in the meantime, had been hired by the Missouri governor to assassinate him.
Now, the two young men there were Bob and Charlie Ford.
Bob and Charlie Ford,
and
yes.
How did they go about killing him?
They just waited for an opportunity, which presented himself. Jesse allowed it to be presented. He turned his back on him. He took his guns off, and, you know, there it was. That's why I believe that it was suicidal.
True that he was standing on a chair hanging up a picture or something along
that
line?
He was dusting a picture,
I
yes.
see, okay.
But there was no reason for him to put himself in that position. It was completely against his character.
You're suggesting here almost that
his unarmed back anywhere on anybody, especially people that he didn't know that well.
But you're suggesting here almost that he had a death wish here, that he wanted to be killed. I mean,
I believe that he did. I believe that he just was tired of the whole thing, and he knew that there was no way out for him.
Was there no way he could get out? I mean, at this point,
he could have gone to prison, but that he was just such an independent spirit that would have killed him too. Hmm. He didn't feel that he could get a fair trial, which maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. We don't know, but he just didn't feel any way out, and he felt that maybe this would be the best for his family, so that they wouldn't have to endure the embarrassment of a trial, you know, of which he would probably be convicted.
Interesting. Well, Bob Ford was the actual assassin. What happened to him after the assassination?
Well, there is speculation that did they ever really receive the money from Governor Crittenden of Missouri, and they probably did receive some, but a lot of people shared in the spoils of that. And he eventually went out to Creedy, Colorado, and opened up a saloon. After trying to go on stage and tell his story of "I killed Jesse James," it wasn't well received. And he opened up a saloon out there, and he was killed out there by another fellow that had nothing to do with Jesse.
The other fellow wasn't looking for revenge
or
a reputation?
No, Bob Ford was not a popular person. Mm. You know, he was into self-aggrandizement, and, you know, he just decided to try to do everything he could to draw attention to himself, which was kind of carrying on the Jesse's tradition, but... Why
don't you think Bob Ford, wouldn't he become a hero for killing the notorious outlaw?
It wasn't popular to kill the notorious outlaw. Jesse was very, very popular. Even though people said, well, you know, he robbed banks and trains, and they were glad that it wasn't them, he still represented the everyman, a lot of it. And he may have been popular, I'm sure he was popular with some people, you know, the Yankee establishment, but for a lot of the people, it was not favorable that he was shot in the back. I mean, that's not the way to do it. If it had been a showdown or something, it might have been completely different. But Bob Ford shot him in the back, and you know, no one liked that, particularly at that time.
Right. Well, still don't. I suppose that's the ultimate slur, that they did it behind his back, stabbed him in the back,
or
whatever.
Well, that's why he was called the dirty little coward.
Right. Right. What about Frank? What happened to him later?
Well, after Jesse was killed, a few months after Jesse was killed, he got together with John Newman Edwards, and they decided that he would surrender, which he did to the governor. And he had three trials. They said, "Look, if you're gonna charge him, let's get it all done with." So he was charged on three counts of murder and robbery, and he was acquitted. He was acquitted on all counts. And then after that, he took a variety of menial jobs and lived out the rest of his life in peace. He died at the age of 72.
Well, let me take you back then. If Frank got off, why wouldn't Jesse have had the same situation?
Well, they felt that a lot of Frank's acquittal was due to the sympathy for the murder of Jesse.
Okay, I understand. Well, the ultimate question, we ask this about all these gunfighter heroes, what do you think the American public chose to make a legend of Jesse James? What about him in particular, and we only have a minute here, made him a hero in the American mind?
Well, I think that most Americans, by virtue of our nationality, have a rebellious nature. And Jesse was the James Dean, the Madonna of his time. He represented freedom and the right to be heard. He's continued to be popular because he was portrayed in film by dashing leading men with guns a-blazing. I get maybe 10 calls a day from people who want me to confirm that they were either related to him directly or to one of his gang members. I think in a time when many people feel a victim of the government or of the power elite, identifying with Jesse James is comforting to them. I think he'll always be popular. I think his life will always be questioned and studied, and he'll always continue to be one of America's foremost legends, probably forever.
Interesting stuff. The rebel, freedom, right to be heard, I suppose rugged individualism in the extreme.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
Right. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, but thank you very much for being with us. That was fascinating. Great. Hope to have you again.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to Marley Brandt, the author of Jesse James, The Man and the Myth, published this year by Berkeley Books. Welcome back to Talking History. For our historic site of the week, following up on our discussion of one of America's most notorious gunfighters, Jesse James, we have picked James' St. Joseph, Missouri home. Here to describe what you will see there is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
If you're on the trail of Jesse James, St. Joseph, Missouri is the place for you. First stop on the must-see places is the Jesse James House Museum, furnished as it looked when the James family lived there. And then there is the Jesse James home, where he was shot and killed, complete with a bullet hole in the wall from the April 1882 shooting. There is also the Buchanan County Courthouse, where the Ford brothers were tried for the murder of Jesse James. And don't miss the Missouri Valley Trust Building, where overland freighters, Confederate and Union soldiers, fur traders, and Pony Express riders all did business in the bank. Local legend has it that Jesse James cased the bank shortly before he was gunned down. There is also the Pony Express Museum and many other rich exhibits of the Old West in St. Joseph. And if you feel like you want to take a bit of the Old West home with you, stop at the Stetson Hat Factory Outlet on your way out of town.
In movies and on television, gunfights in the Old West happened every day, sometimes more than once a day. But just how common were gunfights? What does the historical record show? In this week's op-ed, historian Claire McKenna talks about what he has discovered concerning the reality of gunplay in the Old West. McKenna, professor of history at San Diego State University, is the author of Homicide, Race, and Justice in the American West, published by the University of Arizona Press in 1997. He has titled his op-ed for today, The Myth of the Gunfighter.
The tradition of the gunfight, portrayed in such Western films as High Noon and Shane, still holds power over the imagination of many Americans. However, the Western gunfight is a myth. In the American West, you are more likely to be killed in the saloon than in a traditional gunfight. In the past, historians of the American West have portrayed violence as essentially episodic, involving gunfights in cattle towns and range wars between cattlemen and sheepmen. However, their sources in the traditional narrative style of history have left these authors unaware of the obvious. A common form of lethal violence occurred daily in the American West, homicide, committed by ranchers, farmers, cowboys, coal and copper miners, bartenders, cooks, gamblers, pimps, police officers, sheriff's deputies, roisterous drunks, and yes, occasionally even a housewife. Homicide was commonplace in the West. However, gunfights were rare. In my recent book, Homicide, Race, and Justice in the American West, 1880 to 1920, and in my current research discussing lethal violence in 7 California and 4 Kansas counties, I have examined 2,704 homicide cases. A violent confrontation could occur in virtually any saloon, and statistics confirm that they often did. On numerous occasions, individuals argued over too much foam on the beer, drinks on credit, 50-cent bets, and other minor issues. Vendettas, racial animosities, love triangles, domestic disputes, strikes, and police shootings provide other scenarios for killings. Alcohol figured prominently in homicide scenarios. For example, killers and victims drank prior to committing homicide in about 65% of the cases. However, it is the pervasive nature of gun culture that best illustrates high levels of lethal violence in the American West. The existence of a strong gun culture increased the likelihood that disputes might turn lethal. It was an invitation to violence. Killers ranging in age from 14 to 69 carried cheap handguns patterned on the Webley British Bulldog double-action revolver patented in 1883. Most weighed about 16 ounces and had about 2.5 to 3-inch barrels that could easily be concealed in coat or pants pockets. Harrington Richardson, Ivor Johnson, and other American arms manufacturers copied this design and produced thousands of these five-shot revolvers in .38 and .32 calibers. The consequences are reflected in a handgun homicide rate that averaged 63% and in a combined gun homicide rate of about 75%. Out of 2,704 homicide cases, only around 12 killings fit within the category of what you might call gunfights. Why then has this myth of the gunfights survived? Well, two factors seem to illuminate this: novels and films. Both depicting the American West have ingrained the gunfighter into the American subconscious. Whether it is McMurtry's Lonesome Dove or Clint Eastwood's film Unforgiven, both fiction incidentally, the image of the gunfighter or hired killer looms very large. Nevertheless, it was and is a myth.
You've been listening to Claire McKenna, professor of history at San Diego State University and the author of Homicide, Race, and Justice in the American West, published by the University of Arizona Press. Finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, where we call to your attention upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else that may be of interest to you. The second annual Celebrate History Conference has been scheduled for April 9 through 11 at the South San Francisco Conference Center. Planners of this year's conference, titled All Eras, All Interests, All Together, promise something for just about every history lover. Books, collectibles, living history reenactments, board and computer games, and much more. There may even be a Sweethearts Through History Ball. But to find out more about that, email the organizers at info@celebratehistory.com. And if you're a runner who also likes history, you might sign up for the Vicksburg Run Through History 10K Road Race, which will be held on March 6th. The race starts in the historic Vicksburg, Mississippi National Military Park, which commemorates the Civil War Battle of Vicksburg and traces a route past cannon, reconstructed fortifications and trenches, markers and monuments. For more information on this exercise in history, access the homepage at runthroughhistory.org. Show in our four-part series on the myth of the gunfighter in the American West. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Casey Tiefertiller about Wyatt Earp, whose colorful career is the source of so many myths. But first, let's look back at this week in history. On January 21st, 1793, King Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette were executed. It was the height of the French Revolution, which had begun in 1789, and both had been charged with treason. King Louis and Queen Marie resisted the revolution from the start, agreeing only to what would allow them to remain on the throne. Forever associated with Marie Antoinette, of course, whether she actually uttered it or not, is her supposed response to the starving French peasants, "Let them eat cake." By 1792, Louis and Marie's resistance had not only failed to reverse the tide of revolution, but also had led to the suspension of the king's powers. When his secret dealings with foreign powers, encouraging them to invade France to put down the revolution and restore him to the throne, were discovered, both Louis and Marie were imprisoned, tried for treason, found guilty, and condemned to death. They were guillotined in the Place de la Révolution in Paris. Turning to items of interest in the news, the case of Dr. Samuel Mudd, convicted of conspiracy in the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln in 1865, is in the news again. The morning after Booth shot the president, John Wilkes Booth visited Dr. Mudd seeking treatment for the leg he broke jumping from the president's box to the stage in Ford's Theater. Mudd put a cast on the assassin's leg but later claimed he did not recognize him. A military commission did not believe Mudd and sentenced him to life in prison. He served only 4 years before being pardoned and released, but his name was never cleared. In 1992, Dr. Mudd's grandson, convinced that the Army Board of Corrections of Military Records, that the military tribunal that convicted Mudd lacked jurisdiction, saying Mudd should have been tried in a civil court before a jury of his peers. The board recommended that the verdict be set aside, but Assistant Army Secretary William Clark refused the recommendation. In 1997, Mudd appealed the case to a U.S. District Court. The judge ruled in Mudd's favor and ordered the Army Secretary to decide whether the conviction should be set aside. A decision is expected at any time. You're listening to Talking History. In the first two shows in our series on the myth of the gunfighter, we talked about the origins of America's obsession with outlaws of the Old West and the violent lives they led. and the life and legend of one gunfighter in particular, Jesse James. Today we take up the story of another popular gunfighter, Wyatt Earp. To help us understand this fascinating figure, I'm pleased to welcome Casey Tiefertiller. Mr. Tiefertiller is a former writer for the San Francisco Examiner, whose long interest in Wyatt Earp has resulted in a highly acclaimed, recently published book, Wyatt Earp, The Life Behind the Legend. Mr. Tiefertiller's book has been described by various reviewers as a major contribution to the history of the American West, the first complete and accurate look at Wyatt Earp's colorful career, and the book to end all Earp books. Welcome, Mr. Tiefertiller, and thank you for joining us, and congratulations on the success of your new book.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Brian. I appreciate your interest.
Well, it's great. Good to have you. Let me ask you, just how exaggerated is the myth of the legend of Wyatt Earp?
Well, it's taken on many connotations. Perhaps the strangest exaggeration is in calling him a gunfighter in the same way as Jesse James and John Wesley Hardin and many others. Wyatt Earp only appeared in two stand-up gunfights, really, in his life. And he, all through his career in law enforcement, which was really only a little more than 7 years, his whole effort was to prevent gunplay. He did everything he could to avoid gunfights and was really almost a frontier psychologist more than a gunfighter.
What methods would he use? Was he able to talk people into surrendering? I mean, what did he do?
Well, that he would talk people into surrendering. He would talk them out of committing action. He had a way of stepping up and disarming people as they drew. And he was really tough. He'd beat the heck out of them. He wouldn't kill them, but he'd beat the heck out of them. He'd hit them over the head with a gun. And I guess in a way that's gunfighting, but he didn't pull the trigger. He used it as a club. And all through his career, he had made every effort he could to avoid the gunfights.
Did he have a reputation in his day of being a gunfighter? I mean, did other gunfighters see him as one of their co-equals or whatever?
As he got older, as the myths grew and people talked about how he'd killed 20 or 30 men, which was farcical, he was called a gunfighter, but that was into the late 1890s and after the turn of the century. In his day in Tombstone, people didn't think of him as a gunfighter in Kansas or Tombstone, but people didn't really know about gunfighters then. The term didn't really come along until the 1890s, and he was considered a tough man, both with fists and guns.
How did his reputation get started? How did we first learn to learn? During his time, how did we get to know about Wyatt Earp as a gunfighter?
Wyatt Earp had a small reputation during his days in Kansas. The Police Gazette covered a couple of stories in which he was involved, and his name appeared nationally in the Police Gazette and from events in Kansas. And then by the time he came to Tombstone not to be a law officer, but to try and run a stage line. And when he got to Tombstone, he found himself back embroiled in law enforcement with all the nastiness and the criminality that was going on. And his national reputation really started on October 27th, 1881, the day after the OK Corral, when news reports were spread all around the country of how the Earp brothers had faced off against a band of outlaws. His reputation exploded and became of major national import 5 months later during the Vendetta, after Wyatt had one brother killed, another brother maimed for life. Wyatt went out and led a posse and became judge, jury, and executioner, and went out searching and murdering outlaws. And at that point, newspapers across the country were following the Vendetta on a daily basis and were making Wyatt Earp's name a national name. And for the rest of his life, that fame followed him, whether he wanted it or not.
Most of the other people we've talked about in the series, the other gunfighters, Jesse James and so on, got started in the newspapers much the same way, but then soon made it into cheap novels, and then eventually in the 20th century into film and television. Was that the same trajectory more or less for Earp?
Very different, actually. What happened with him, most of those cheap novels that you mentioned were done of people who were dead, who couldn't refute the legend that was being made of them, with the exception of Hickok, of course, who had novels written about him during his time. There were no cheap novels written about Wyatt Earp. There were a number of newspaper and magazine stories during his life through the late 1880s and into the 1890s and as long as he lived talking about it. But Wyatt Earp ran into a very unusual situation. In 1896, he sat down for a big interview with the San Francisco Examiner, and it really spread his fame. It was a big three-part interview, and shortly after that, he was selected to referee a prize fight, and he awarded the decision on a foul, and it was very controversial. He was accused of fixing the fight and doing and illegally fixing the fight, and it was horrendously embarrassing for him. And so after 1896, he really shut up. He really quit talking. He quit trying to get his name out there until the situation had gotten very strange. By the 1920s, there had been many magazine stories come out and call him an outlaw and a criminal and all kinds of horrible things, which he knew were not true. And he finally tried to get somebody to write his biography, a friend of his named John Flood. It was just a terrible effort. Flood couldn't write at all. And after the Flood effort failed, and that had been in part with William S. Hart, the old silent movie actor, who had been trying to get the biography written so that Hart could make a movie out of it. And after that effort failed, Wyatt Earp met a magazine writer named Stuart N. Lake, who would come out with a book called Wyatt Earp Frontier Marshal, which in many ways captured the whole image of the West. It's a wonderful book, wonderfully written. It tells about Wyatt's life. It gives essentially his side of the story. But Wyatt died during the making of this book, during the writing of this book, and so Wyatt never saw the final product. And so Lake had gone out and talked to other people and found a few stories that were not quite true. He exaggerated a few stories, and he built Wyatt Earp into the greatest hero who ever wrote the West. And out of that, the book appeared in 1931, and almost instantly it became a magnet for movies. Out of that, there were two movies about Wyatt Earp that came out quickly, and then after World War II came My Darling Clementine, which had been in preparation before the war, and that set off just all kinds of movies, and the image of Wyatt Earp has just grown dynamically through movies and television.
How important was it that he was also a lawman? I mean, he's one of the few gunfighters, if you can still use that phrase, that we've considered in the series, who was a lawman for at least a part of his career. What effect did that have on his reputation?
Well, I think his reputation was very strange because after the Vendetta, there were huge debates because the population was greatly divided. The population of Arizona was greatly divided on whether Earp had acted properly or whether he had acted improperly. And what he had done, the situation was this. The laws were not protecting the citizenry. If criminals were brought in, they always had alibi witnesses. They always had ways to get off. So there was no choice, there was no other way to protect the citizenry than for Wyatt Earp to become a law unto himself. And that left a very divided legacy in Arizona, where about half the population thought he was a great hero and half thought that he was a horrible outlaw. And for the lingering effect, his role as a lawman had a great impact because as with Lake, where Lake built the legend and made Wyatt stand as the greatest lawman in history, in many ways, the greatest lawman in American history, it had a great effect on cementing his popularity through movies for generations to come.
I want to come back to that point again because I think it's important when we consider Earp as a hero here, but let me ask you just one other sort of informational point. You mentioned O.K. Corral, and that's certainly the one event that we all, if we know anything about Earp, that comes to mind. Can you give us at least one other major event in Earp's life that we ought to recall or something we could learn from that?
Well, Wyatt Earp was a very interesting character all through his life. He had remarkable toughness and remarkable qualities. Even when he was 62 years old, he led a posse into the California outback, and it was a face-off over a mining claim. And Wyatt Earp had his posse, and another group came up, and they were all armed, and Wyatt Earp walked over to the other group, grabbed the shotgun out of the man's hand, and with a burst of profanity told him, "It was too early in the morning to have a fight. Let's sit down and eat breakfast." And they sat down and ate breakfast. The whole situation was diffused. The other party left, and instead of gunfight, they were left to let things be decided in court.
That's a great story. I like that one.
Oh, it's an incredible story. And one of the people who was there said, "I never saw a man show so much nerve as Wyatt Earp showed that day."
How would you summarize his years in Dodge City? Again, usually the substance of many films.
Well, Dodge City is wonderful because Dodge City was started by the liquor dealers expressly for the idea of taking money from the Texans. The Texans would drive cattle up to the railhead, and Dodge City was awash with saloons, brothels, dance halls, every entertainment a man could want. And so the Texas cowboys would come up, and they weren't outlaws. They were just generally rowdy troublemakers. It was like Palm Springs on spring break more than anything else. And the job was not to kill people, but to prevent the rowdies from getting out of hand. And what Wyatt Earp did during that period was he kept those guys from getting into trouble. He might hit them over the head with his gun. He might beat them up. He might do anything, but he'd have them out of jail the next morning so they could go buy more liquor and spend more money on the ladies in the brothels. And during that period, probably the defining instance for him was there was a woman murdered named Dora Hand, who was a saloon singer. And he and Bat Masterson went out on a posse and found were able to locate the killer, and that made national news. It was in the Police Gazette, and was probably the first part of Wyatt Earp's national, the major part of Wyatt Earp's national fame that he got early in life. But for him, I think Dodge City was an experience learning how to be a lawman, learning that the role of a lawman is can often be preventing problems rather than acting after the problems are already done. And much of what he did was prevent problems in Dodge City.
Okay. Well, one of the questions I've asked all of the people we've interviewed in this whole series is, you know, why the American people decided to make a legend of whatever outlaw we were talking about or whatever gunfighter we were talking about. What was it about Wyatt Earp? What did we single out, and why did we hold that up as a characteristic to make him a hero?
Wyatt Earp did something that nobody has ever done, nobody else has ever done in American history. Wyatt Earp stepped beyond the law to become the super law officer. We see it now in movies with Dirty Harry and RoboCop, but what Wyatt Earp did was step beyond the law to preserve order. And no law officer has ever done that. I think it's a dream of many law officers not to be hampered by the courts. But Wyatt Earp, on his own, was able to take it upon himself to go out and eradicate a crime problem without being hampered by courts, juries, or judges. And he was willing to step beyond the law and take his own chances with that. And in retrospect, in a land where we are a land of laws, you look at what he did, and we have to say that what he did was wrong, but in this case it was necessary, because if he hadn't done that, Tombstone would have fallen into chaos and absolute disorder.
Well, that's interesting, because in the very first moments of this series, Richard Slotkin made somewhat the same point, only he said that one of the reasons that we mythologize these figures is because they do step outside the law, because they do take things into their own hand. And he mentioned it in the context of vigilantism. But to him, that was not a heroic thing. That, as you suggested in your remarks just at the end of that answer, that this wasn't necessarily something that we should praise. But yet you seem to, in some ways, see this as a heroic quality.
Well, I think, actually, this is part, that's a great question, Brian. one of the things that makes Wyatt Earp interesting in this point is Wyatt Earp had, all through his career, acted to diffuse vigilanteism. He'd stopped vigilantes from hanging a little gambler named Johnny Behind the Deuce. He'd been part, with his brothers, he had been part of a group to stop the hanging of Johnny Behind the Deuce. He'd acted in many ways. He had always been opposed to vigilantism until the point where there was no other choice. And I think this is something where this is almost a personal choice for everyone who examines this issue, and something that really resounds in our feelings. Is this heroic, or did he do something very wrong that should be, and he should be demonized for it? And this was a hard question for me. It's a hard question when you grow up in a nation of laws where the laws generally work. But you have to understand that sometimes there are cultures and areas where the laws fail to work. And in this instance, in this one particular instance, had Wyatt Earp not acted, there's a good chance that the outlawry would have so controlled the town that other citizens would be killed, and it would have been a whole nightmare situation.
Okay.
I think he was a hero in this regard.
Great. Well, thank you. And I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there. We're out of time, but thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Brian.
You've been listening to Casey Tiefertiller, author of Wyatt Earp, The Life Behind the Legend, published by John Wiley & Sons. Welcome back to Talking History. For our historic site of the week, following up on our discussion of Wyatt Earp, we've picked a place long associated with Earp, Dodge City, Kansas. Here to tell us about Dodge City is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Dodge City, located west of Wichita in southwest Kansas, has been called many things, most notably Hell on the Plains and the wickedest little city in America. It is famous for its rich history as a frontier cow town. Many of the early settlers in Dodge City were gamblers, gunslingers, and cattlemen. Thousands of longhorn cattle were driven into Dodge City over the Texas Trail, and it became a rowdy town famous for its saloons, outlaws, and Boot Hill Cemetery. Bat Masterson and Wyatt Earp earned their fame as lawmen during this time. A popular tourist destination, there are several places to see today in Dodge City, the authentic replica of Front Street with the Long Branch Saloon and Boot Hill Cemetery among them.
For our weekly op-ed, we continue on the subject of the myth of the gunfighter, and in particular the myth surrounding Wyatt Earp's famous shootout at the OK Corral. Here to tell us about those myths is Alan Barra, author of Inventing Wyatt Earp, recently published by Carolyn Graf.
116 years ago, last Monday, at about 2:47 in the afternoon, Virgil Wyatt and Morgan Earp, accompanied by a young tubercular dentist gambler from Georgia named John Henry Doc Holliday, turned left off Fremont Street, now Highway 80, in the sprawling Silver Boom camp of Tombstone, Arizona, then to a vacant lot in the back of the OK Corral. Virgil Earp, the town marshal, said, "Boys, throw up your hands. I want your guns." After which two quick shots were heard. 30 seconds later, every man in the fight was dead or wounded except Wyatt Earp. The gunfight in back of the OK Corral has become part of our American mythology, even an enduring international symbol of American confrontation. In July, the Toronto Star cautioned General Motors and the United Auto Workers that, quote, both could learn a lesson or two from the gunfight at the OK Corral. And in August, the Singapore paper warned that, quote, a trigger-happy America blazing away to glory like Wyatt Earp at the OK Corral inspires no confidence in its role as global policeman. In fact, international symbol may not completely capture the gunfight's hold in the popular imagination. In an episode of Star Trek, Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock were forced to fight the Earps at the OK Corral. Kirk, it seems, must have landed on planet Hollywood. All of which belies the gunfight itself, which wasn't that big a deal after all. What happened was, the Earp brothers went down to arrest Ike and Billy Clanton and Frank and Tom McClowry, four men affiliated with a group of cow thieves known as the Cowboys. In cow towns like Dodge City, he was renowned for his ability to keep the peace without firing a shot. The men he killed in the lot in Tombstone may have been the first he ever killed. Since his death, Wyatt Earp's image has gone through three distinct phases. First, in the 1930s, he was evoked as an antidote to big city gangsters like Al Capone and Dutch Schultz. In the second, from about the end of World War II through the Eisenhower era, he stood for America's Cold War resolve, holding the thin blue line in defense of democratic ideals. By the late 1960s, his name was linked with predatory white America. In the 1971 film, Doc, a Vietnam War allegory with a script by Pete Hamill, Wyatt was a sadistic bully who made Lyndon Johnson-type speeches over his murdered enemies. Why did history in Hollywood choose to make the gunfight at the OK Corral immortal? The partial answer is that Americans have always looked to the West, to the Alamo, to Custer's Last Stand, to the OK Corral, for defining moments in our national character. Another is that, in time, post-Marxist historians saw the Earps and Cowboys as representatives of opposing culture and political forces. The Earps were Republicans who worked for Eastern capitalists like Wells Fargo, in the words of one sociologist, and corporation gunfighters, while the Cowboys were resistance gunfighters of Southern democratic values, if those values can be stretched to include cattle and stagecoach theft. Why Wyatt Earp has been singled out is a more complex question. The answer may have less to do with the gunfight than what followed it. In retaliation for the Tombstone fight, Virgil and Morgan were ambushed, and Morgan was killed. Wyatt then formed a posse and hunted down the assassins, bringing back no prisoners. Wyatt Earp never apologized for his actions, and he died without finishing his autobiography. But nothing would have struck Wyatt Earp as odder than the way people have used his name to push their agenda. In 1996, Patrick J. Buchanan kicked off his presidential campaign by posing with guns and gun belt in front of the OK Corral. It's a good thing for Mr. Buchanan that Earp wasn't at this media bash. He might have hauled him off to court for violating local gun control laws.
You've been listening to Alan Barra, author of Inventing Wyatt Earp, published by Carroll and Graff.
You have been listening to another edition of Talking History. Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. For more information about Talking History, write Talking History, Department of History, University at Albany, 1400 Washington Avenue, Albany, New York, 12222.